Welcome to Worlds Apart. The year of 2022 upset the apple cart of international politics in more ways than one, but the launch of the Russian military operation in Ukraine has definitely divided the historical timeline into before and after, not only for those with a direct stake in the conflict, but also for those watching from the sidelines. What will it take to ride the cart and get the sides moving towards peace? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined from Toronto by Nivedita Daskundu, senior researcher at York University and author of several books on relations between India and the countries of the former Soviet Union. Dr. Nivedita, it's a great honor, great pleasure for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Oksana. Thank you for the invitation and giving me the opportunity to speak with the audience through your medium. And I have been following World Trade and RT, so I'm really happy to be part of this show.
That's amazing because I found your personal and academic background extremely interesting. And I think it provides a unique vantage point onto this conundrum because you spent years growing up and studying in both Russia and Ukraine. Then you went on to further your academic career in the West while also keeping in touch with your country of origin, India, which has long strived for a balanced position. So I think you have this unique combination of both proximity and distance to everybody involved in this war. And I'm wondering, where do you find yourself in all of this, not only as an academic, but also as a human being?
I have spent a lot of my time in Russia as well as in Ukraine. During my early academic years, I was in Russia, and then I also studied in Ukraine in the Kyiv, in the International Relations Institute, as my specialization is international relations. Academically, I've been involved with this region for now many decades, and I've been working, and my research is focusing mainly on this region. So I have some sort of understanding and clarity of the present situation and why it is today like this and why it appears whatever it is today. Because this is, as we all know, this is not a one-day or two-day conflict. This has been going on for many years. And as I mentioned that I have lived there, I know this two countries, people are very much connected with each other. Their culture, cuisine, they're very similar to each other, and they have relatives as well as within their family, either father or mother or grandfather, grandmother, somebody is belongs to either from Russia or from Ukraine.
Dr. Nivedita, can I stop you here for a second? Because this is a very important point. Both you and many other experts described Russia and Ukraine as not the same, but similar. You know, there are certain sort of cultural and ethnic substance that we have in common. And yet, when we talk to the Ukrainians, especially the political leadership of Ukraine, they present it as if there could be no more different countries, no more different people than the Russians and the Ukrainians. And in fact, part of their political paradigm is to present Ukraine as the very antidote of Russia. And if that was only political thing, okay, that's their choice. But they, as you know, I'm sure very well, even before the outbreak of this conflict, there was a widespread discrimination or suppression of Russian language, of Russian culture, of Russian way of being, even though I think deep down, it's not that much different from the Ukrainian. How do you explain all that resentment? Is it just like the natural pains of separation, or do you think that's deliberate?
you know, in Ukraine, they had the some sort of a feeling that they did not get their right share during the Soviet times, and their language, their literature did not get that much opportunity as the Russian language. So that was one of the reasons. Another reason is they were very keen to be part of the Euro-Atlantic community, and they felt that they are more of the European than they are towards the Russia. So that is another reason. So we have seen this ethnic problems and the problems specifically faced by those people who are living in the eastern part of Russia, who were mainly Russian-speaking and Russian-origin people, as well as we have seen in some parts of central and southern part, but western part was a little different. And this Ukrainization and the language, popularizing this language, that became very, very common and very, very, very prominent. Then all the publications, the newspapers started coming out in Ukrainian language. The schools, whose medium was actually earlier Russian language, they stopped that and they started teaching only in the Ukrainian language. And also enormous funding was coming to engage people to write and come out with more Ukrainian propagandas and Ukrainianization. And I must tell you that external powers also had a lot of hand in igniting this kind of feelings, because this clearly divided the internal domestic population. And we know that there were a lot of foreign NGOs at that time were in the initial years were based in Kyiv and other parts of Ukraine, and they were funding to encourage this kind of attitudes and movement, which was definitely painful to see. But yes, that kind of Ukrainization started from very beginning, and they wanted to very deliberately move away, though they knew that Russia is very important for them. But still, they did this kind of, and they followed this move.
You mentioned this sort of grievance, the perception that the Ukrainian language or Ukraine as a republic didn't get enough attention or enough respect from the Soviet authorities. And as somebody who actually studied Soviet national policies, national and ethnic policies, I can attest to the fact that, if I'm not mistaken, but I think I'm pretty close to the truth, Ukraine was the largest recipient of Soviet funding in absolute terms. And the same goes for, you know, the support of the language, the support of the culture, infrastructure, what have you. Georgia, by the way, I think was the largest recipient in per capita terms. And yet those two republics have developed this very strong resentment, despite receiving much more than ethnic Russians or many other people that made up the former Soviet Union. It's fascinating to me, but one question I wanted to ask you is, why do you think the Georgian War of 2008 was so much different from the Ukrainian conflict that is still ongoing? Because back then, many of the sort of dynamics preceding the war were similar. Western funding, you know, national grievances, etc. But Russia didn't go all the way to occupy any of the territories of Georgia, and it stopped short of absorbing breakaway republics into itself. Why do you think the Russian rationale has changed this time around?
Well, when you are comparing this Ukrainian war with Georgia, that is that debate has been going on since the Ukraine-Russia war started. So there are a lot of similarities that we can see. Like in Ukraine also, this revolution feeling started from the Orange Revolution funded by Western nations. In Georgia also, we have seen the Rose Revolution, which was heavily funded by the Western nations. They also had a Western affiliated leaders, and also Mikhail Saakashvili was the same in Georgia. So there were a lot of similarities, and they also, Georgia also wanted to be part of the NATO, and Ukraine also want to be part of European Union.
Well, Ukrainian
and NATO.
Leadership, political leadership wants to be part of NATO. It's not so clear whether it's the case when you look at the polls.
Yes, yes. Well, I was writing this book and sitting in Ukraine, and during that time, I interviewed different agents age group people, I mean, people, the millennials, then people in the middle age, as well as the older age people. So I found that younger generation, they were very, very much enthusiastic to get affiliated with European Union because they get, thought that that will open their gateway and they will become more Western and they can access a lot of facilities. Whether the middle aged people, they understood that their affiliation with Russia, their linkage with Russia is very important to sustain the stability in the country and maintain whatever the relationship they have. And the older people were very much in favorable to maintain the relation with Russia. But what is the difference here? Well, first and foremost, I would like to mention that that war which started in around 2008, that time it was totally different Russia. Today's Russian leader has got a much more understanding about how to tackle this type of issues, and they understand that what is the best option here. And that was definitely a provocating from both the sides. At that point of time, when Georgia-Russia war was going on, that time Russia was also facing a problem with its own people, like say there were Chechen conflict, also the neighboring South Caucasus, like Azerbaijan, Armenia was having problem. Then South Ossetia was trying to merge with the Russian Federation, and they were having the fear of a spillback to the North Ossetia. So those kind of things were also there, and so that is why that war lasted for very long a period. And at the same time, I would also say that this war is more of an information war. Like here, we see a lot of disinformation, a lot of social media, a lot of internet is giving and spreading the information, which is also confusing much more to the general population and creating more complex situation. And here also another problem I would like to mention, that international community is much more involved in a different way, which was not there at the time of the Georgia-Russia war.
Now, Dr. Nivedita, if I can seize upon your statement that Russia between 2008 and 2022 has changed dramatically, including the thinking of the Russian leadership. And I think one of the most popular explanations in the West for this turnaround in the Russian position is Putin's personal grandeur, that he became older, he started, he became perhaps more delusional, started imagining himself as this new Russian emperor set on conquering, if not the world, then at least, you know, the space of the former Soviet Union. Do you buy that explanation?
Well, definitely not. I mean, today's Russian leader is a totally different leader than what it was earlier. And West has got some kind of, you know, I mean, forming their own perception that evil and hero. Like they are putting President Zelensky as a hero and bringing him in every sphere of life, and they are giving him the opportunity to share his views not only in forums and summits but also in universities to the younger people, whereas making President Putin as a villain. But that is definitely not the case, and we know that he understands what is good for their nation, which is good for its people. And if you see Russian military doctrine, of course you know very well that in the Russian military doctrine they have mentioned that if there is any kind of threat to the Russian-speaking population or Russian citizens living in the former Soviet states, then Russia can go to the extent of using force to protect their nationals. And they have been doing this similar to what it was mentioned in their agreements. And we know that Minsk II and Minsk I, Minsk II, they were there, these agreements were also not followed. So just having a blame game or just demonizing somebody does not really solve the issue, which is actually different. And this kind of provocation will definitely not make much sense.
Well, Dr. Nivedita, what makes sense right now is taking a very short break, but we will be back to this fascinating discussion in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Nivedita Daskundu, senior researcher at York University and author of several books on relations between India and the countries of the former Soviet Union. Dr. Nivedita, before the break, we were talking about this extreme personalization or sort of a Manichaean thinking of dividing the world into the forces of good and the forces of evil. And one other feature of Western analysis that is very surprising and striking to me is a pretension that structural reasons don't exist. I mean, when you listen to Western policymakers, they go to extreme lengths to put everything on Russia, pretending as if NATO, for example, and Russia's security concerns over NATO don't exist. They also, for some reason, for many years, turned blind eyes not only to ethnic discrimination, but they openly supported not just nationalist, but openly xenophobic forces, and not only in Ukraine, but also in many other countries of the former Soviet Union, for example, the Baltic states. Would it be an exaggeration on my part to suggest that when it comes to Russia, everything goes, that the West doesn't feel bound by its own supposed norms?
Well, you are very correct in saying so, because West feels that whatever they are doing and whatever they want to do, that has been going on for quite some time. So that has become kind of a practice and a norm that what they do, that is correct. And what others are thinking and doing at this point, that thing is definitely not correct. So you have probably noticed that this is very much, this showed that how India differed from the West in taking a number of decisions related to Ukraine-Russia relations. Because Western media and Western propagandas was such that whatever West is thinking, that is the correct and that should be agreed. Which is definitely not. Today's world is changed. Today is a globalized world. People has got different thought process. And yes, when they talk about human rights violation, so are they looking into the human rights violation in their own nations? And what are they doing for that? Are they really actively working for that and protecting the people? No, we don't see that always. So when they criticize others and when they talk about other nations and other people, because what my understanding is every country understands their national interest. If they are thinking their national interest and they are concerned about their security issues, like you saw that how the balloon issue that I mean, they, one was concerned about the security concern and that's why it was shot back. So definitely every country is concerned about their own
if I may stop you here for just for a second to further our discussion. I think my perception of covering geopolitics for many years is that it's not only that countries need to understand their own national interests, but they usually understand the national interests of their partners or their opponents, and they genuinely try to find some midway. That is considered to be the basis of balance, the basis of peace. Why do you think the West has very little respect for this structure of international politics, that it's not only them who have interest, you know, other countries in the world by nature, by their very nature, have something, some security concerns, some national imperatives that they have to protect regardless of whether the West approves of it or not?
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct, because that is what has been happening. And probably they had the idea that it will go on like that. But when it differed, then they have a problem. And then they try to push in a different way. And at this point of time, I would definitely say that all the international community, global community should come together. Instead of sending heavy arms and artilleries and tanks, they should sit together and think through that how the these two nations can come to the table. And though these are bilateral relations, that through bilateral exchanges and talks they have to dissolve, but the international community has to come together. Instead of igniting that, they should understand that how peace should be prevailed and how the innocent people of these countries who are suffering, their suffering can be reduced. And I must say that this war has not only affected these two nations, this war has affected the whole world. And one has to really understand that how the situation is worsening, because we just came out of the pandemic and this war started, and we are now problems are continuing. The inflation that is creating so much of a problem, energy concerns, supply chain management concerns, everything. So everything is linked with this. So one has to think that instead of supplying the ammunition, they should sit and think how the peace can prevail.
Well, let us show them some example. Since you mentioned peace, let's try to see how it could be realized, because in geopolitics, as I'm sure you know, peace is not an abstract concept. It's actually a very practical calculation when all the protagonists or antagonists decide that, you know, their interests are better served by stopping hostilities rather than continuing them. And when it comes to Russia and Ukraine, they're bleeding profusely, both of these countries. But what about the West? Do you think the West has had or has sustained enough losses in this proxy war to actually be an advocate, a genuine advocate and well-wisher for peace?
Well, as I just mentioned, this war, of course, it's extremely painful to see that how profusely this two nations people are suffering and bleeding, and how the younger generation, I deal a lot with the younger generation, I see that they don't even see how their future is going to be. And if you see today's Ukraine, even if today the peace prevails and the situation normalizes, then also it will take many years to revert back to the normal situation. So they have to think of all these. And today, when we talk about the peace, that is not only essential for this particular region, also it is very important for the whole world. Say it. Europe's, you see how Europe is suffering. They are breaking within. They are having so many problems within their own nations. They are having problems within European Union. They are having problems with their neighboring nations. And they are not in consensus with their own decisions, because their own people are suffering. They are suffering. We have seen that how defense minister of Germany resigned because she could not agree on whatever was demanding by the NATO. The common people, they are suffering. The political leaders, they do a lot of things thinking of their own benefit a lot of time, and they can't see how the nation really will benefit and how the common people will benefit and what sufferings are happening. Even in the in Atlantics, you see that how inflation has grown, how the energy prices has gone up, and everything is not really in normal shape today. So that is why it's very important.
Yeah, I agree with you that it's hugely important, although I think those people who are making decisions are perhaps not feeling the pinch just as intensely as the ordinary folks. That's why they can go on with pretending that Ukraine and the supply of weapons is going to solve the problem. Speaking of which, you are joining us from Canada, which not only has a very large Western Ukrainian diaspora, but also what I would call a diabolically anti-Russian government, because Canada's Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland, who is also of Western Ukrainian descent, said last year that the world's democracies can be safe only once the Russian tyrant and his armies are entirely vanquished. Now, the word vanquished is a very interesting choice of words in the Russian context, because Russia has one of the largest militaries in the world. How do you interpret that statement? How do you see a country like Canada vanquishing Russia?
Well, it is very unfortunate that this type of words have been used by one of the important leader of the country. But yes, there is a huge Ukrainian diaspora living in different parts of Canada. And they are, of course, they are contributing a lot for the Canadian economy. But since the Ukraine-Russia war started, we have seen this anti-Russia and pro Ukraine propagandas, pro-Ukraine agendas and are being more popular. And of course, we have seen that, of course, Ukrainian flags almost in every building, in every car. And also, Russian had faced a number of times this kind of a discrimination that was definitely not there earlier, but they started facing. So here, that is also very important to say, though they are contributing. But one has to understand that what is the best option for them and how the country like Canada should treat both the communities. So that is one thing I must say. But another way, of course, you must know that political leaders, they try to use the terms, the words which are favorable for their vote bank. So and Canada is going for the election in 1.5 years time. Within the Canada also, they are facing a lot of problems post-pandemic related to pandemic issues. Their problem related to healthcare issues. They're facing problem related to indigenous population. I mean, they're trying to bring them in the mainstream, and there were a lot of issues earlier which they're trying to resolve it. So also a lot of time political leaders, they use such terms to divert the attention of the domestic population from the domestic problems to the other problems.
But isn't it ultimately extremely cynical? Because it's one thing to support the Ukrainian people and put out the Ukrainian flag. It's another thing to endorse the idea that you should fight with Russia, a country that holds very strong nuclear capabilities until the very end. I mean, aren't Ukrainians, the Ukrainians in Ukraine, the ones who will be paying for these political ambitions of the supposed Ukrainian supporters in Canada?
Yes, I mean, if somebody is not understanding the Russian military power and capabilities, that is that is really unfortunate, because the whole world knows Russian military powers and capabilities. Of course, if you say India has been one of the best partners of Russia for last 60 to 65 years, and their defense cooperation is going very strong till date. Earlier, it was almost 70% of the defense equipment which is to come from Russia. And even today, we see almost 50% of Russian equipment are being used by India. So, Russia is definitely a military power. And we have also seen in this recent war that how Russia, managed in the war front. And there is no doubt on that. If somebody is speaking on that, then we should not take them very seriously. They have some other intentions probably to focus on.
Well, Dr. Nivedita, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Tsan.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.